This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp to provide you with access to the largest online therapy service in the world. And it can all be done from the comfort of your own home, from a phone, tablet or laptop. No commute, cutting down travel costs, and most importantly, it's affordable. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. If you need someone to talk to and you're thinking of giving therapy a go, BetterHelp is a great option. And being a listener of the podcast, you get 10% off. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. That's betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. Welcome to A Life in Film.
I'm Elliot James Langridge. I'm an actor, writer, and apparently a podcaster. And I love film. This is the podcast that we ask our guests from in front and behind the camera, how did they get their foot in the door? What was the key to unlocking their success? What's their story?
Previous guests include Toby Jones, Sam Clement, Natalie Emmanuel, Andrea Riseborough, and Tony Curran, to name a few. From The Dark Knight to Mortal Kombat, and his latest show, American Born Chinese, our guest today is actor Chin Han. It's a life in film! It's a life in film!
Hi, Elliot. Are you in London or are you in...
Yeah, London. Yeah, whereabouts are you? I'm guessing you're not in London.
I'm in LA right now. So London is 6 p.m. in the evening.
Yeah.
I love London. I just haven't had the opportunity to go back in a while. Yeah.
Oh, were you filming here for anything, or why was the last time you were in London?
Well, I come over for vacation quite frequently. My family has a place there, and nice. So that's always fun for me. But the last time I shot there was for The Dark Knight, and I do look forward to going back to shoot again. It's been a while, obviously.
I mean, if you're going to come over and shoot anything, The Dark Knight is probably a good one to be a part of. not too bad. How long were you shooting that movie for?
I was on it for quite a few months because they shot in so many different countries, right? I think they shot in London and Chicago. I think they started in Chicago and then we moved to London and then it was Chicago and it was back to London again. And I think the final location was Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. So I joined them a little later, obviously. But it still was quite a few months of work.
Mm. And I mean, you'd been, well, if we go right back to the beginning, you'd been acting a while before you did The Dark Knight. But am I right in thinking that just before, well, you'd had a kind of time of hiatus before you got that role? Am I right in thinking that?
Yes. I mean, I had started out in the theater, and then that was a lot of fun. And then, you know, I think... when I graduated from university, the TV station came calling with a TV show. And so I joined that soap. I think that's the best way to describe it. That was created by some of the people who did the original soaps here in the U.S., like Dallas and Falcon Crest. But they have been co-opted and brought over to Asia to set us up that way. So I did that, and I think after about two to three years, I think I just felt a little I felt like I didn't have much to offer that particular genre of TV, and I kind of also kind of lost my passion for it. But I knew I wanted to be involved in creating things and creating stories and telling stories. So I started producing and directing, and that was very satisfying for me for about 8 years. I did one or two odd things in between. One was actually quite an interesting film in 2003 called Three Needles with an indie film director, Tom Fitzgerald. And that's very interesting because that's where I first met Lucy Liu as well. And
Oh,
who was to know 20 years later, was it 20 years? About 20 years later, we are reunited. We are reunited on set again for American-born Chinese, this time with her as a director. So,
wow, she's directed this. That's amazing.
yeah, she directed one episode of American-born Chinese. And we had a whole bunch of great directors. I think Destin Daniel Cretton directed two of them. It was so lovely to have him. But that was my time, the 8 years before The Dark Knight, kind of happened.
That's amazing to be able to do, a bit of other things as well, not just the acting, but then, did a bit of producing, a bit of directing. That's kind of the actor's dream, isn't it? To be able to put your foot in and try different things. And have you got a favorite? I mean, obviously you've done a lot of acting, but would you like to go back to the directing? I'm presuming you're still producing things as you're working now, but do you favor one more than the other?
I enjoy directing because, you get to work with the actors, and I love working with actors. I mean, either as a co-star or as a director, producing you there's so many more things to consider. And in the time that I was actually producing and directing, I have to clarify that I was actually doing theater, but the productions were medium to large size productions. Obviously, the kind of financing, the kind of structures and deals are a little different when you're doing a film than when you're doing theater. But in some ways, theater is equally scary, right? Because you either open, a successful show, or you're pretty much dead in the water. Whereas for TV, you have a long tail there. You have other ancillaries. There are a lot of movies, especially in the 80s and 90s, which didn't do that well in the theater, but had an incredible lifespan, in DVDs and VHS. So theater actually, I feel, is like, in some ways, the capitalization on the play obviously is lower than that for a film, especially back then. I mean, when it wasn't digital, right? When you're shooting a film, that is really costly compared to, now how you can make a movie now. Even though the capitalization is lower on in theater than it is on film, but it is, I feel, it's
I
riskier,
can
really.
imagine, yeah. Well, like you said, with film, you can have a flop, and then, a decade later, something happens, and suddenly it catches on DVD or Blu-ray or whatever it is, and it can have an afterlife, after its release, and still make its money back. I guess with theatre, it either works or it doesn't work, and then
I
it's
mean,
over.
look at Carrie the musical, right? I mean, that's done and dusted, it's finished. Whereas a movie like Blade Runner, which wasn't that well received when it opened, is now really just a seminal piece of cinema.
That's the crazy thing, though, isn't it? That people that are, growing up now, if they're a fan of, say, Blade Runner, they'll be like, well, it must have been a hit because now everyone loves it and it's this renowned movie. But, Shawshank Redemption's another one where it did okay, but now it's known as one of the best movies ever made. And it's funny how that happens.
No, it's true. And the opposite, the reverse is true too, right? I mean, you have movies that you feel like are artistically, monumental, like The Godfather or 2001: A Space Odyssey. But you forget, I mean, sometimes we forget how commercially successful those movies were, right? They box office blockbusters,
Yeah, no, definitely. So, I mean, there's a I don't know if you've seen the show, The Offer, about that. It's essentially about the making of The Godfather, but it's a drama, and Dexter Fletcher's directed it, and it's got an incredible cast. But I don't know how close it is to the what actually happened. But when you watch that, it makes you realize the work that goes into making something like that. And a film, I mean, the tagline on that show was the greatest movie almost never made, because there were so many points where it nearly didn't happen. And it's kind of mind-boggling to think that now, I mean, it being the classic that it is. But if you
It's so
haven't seen the
funny
show, I'd watch it. It's
that
really good.
I was at the premiere, so I saw the first two episodes of it. But it's funny because I met Al Ruddy, the producer, years and years ago, back in the 90s. And obviously then, you know, I've met Miles Teller on various occasions here in LA as well. So yeah, I mean, you have the man himself and the person playing the man. So
I mean, the stories of El Ruddy, he's seems like a huge character. I mean, the stories are crazy.
Well, the producers back then were all kind of characters, right? They were larger than life, right? I mean, there were people like Robert Evans. And even when you moved into the 80s and 90s, like the Joel Silvers and the, Barry Josephson, or, I mean, they're the big, you know, they're the big characters, or the Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer, right?
So that
was the time.
I mean, you do hear of stories around that time, and it sounds like the Wild West in comparison to what it is now. Sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad, but that period of time is definitely it's been and gone now. But I'd like to talk about what was your initial kind of interest in acting? What kind of like got you going into it? Was there a family member or someone that influenced you and brought you into it? How did it happen?
Well, you know, my family, I think we're all kind of interested in the arts, right? My brother is an attorney, but, you know, he's like an award-winning photographer. My sister was a banker, you know, but, you know, now raising six lovely children. But she, in her time, danced ballet, played the koto. She still plays the piano. So art was always in our family. My mom is very literary. My dad loves to sing. He was on a nationally televised singing competition for seniors.
Oh, you know, wow.
When he was older, and he made it all the way to the semifinals, I think.
Amazing.
So I think I was the only one who actually did it full time. I think, you know, that got to do it full time, but it's always been in the family, you know. I think my mom says this, that when she had me, basically she watched a lot of movies during that time, you know, which was, I think, the year 1969. And so maybe that accounted for my interest in movies. But I've always loved movies. I mean, even from a very young age. And I would seek out, you know, VHS videotapes were not that easy to find, right? And I think they were quite pricey as well at that point. So for me, after a good movie, after a movie I've seen, this is like when I'm 6 or 7 or 8 or 9, you know, for me to retain a piece of the movie, I would either go to the bookstore to find a movie tie-in, right? One of those books that are movie tie-in books. I remember after Alien came out, I went to the bookstore to get Alan Dean Foster's novelization of the movie. But that's how I would kind of retain, you know, my memory of the film, or go and get a soundtrack on a cassette or something. So it's been a long time coming. I mean, I've always loved movies. I never thought I would be so involved and front and center, you know, in the business. But I did love all of it.
Mm. You mentioned Alien there. Do you have a film that kind of something that you can just watch over and over again, like not your favorite film, because I think that's the impossible question, isn't it, but a couple of movies that you really like, you can always go back to, that you love watching?
I have some guilty pleasures, you know. I love the Zucker Abrams comedies, so I can watch Airplane over and over again.
It's so good.
And then their later works too, like Top Secret, because they've done the Airplane, I think Top Secret is kind of neglected very often, but Top Secret is a masterpiece in my mind. I can see that over and over again. I do enjoy rom-coms too. I think I've seen When Harry Met Sally quite a few times.
So good. Such a good film.
And then I just recently rewatched Labyrinth.
Oh wow, these are all absolute bangers on my book. I love all those movies. Yeah, I heard somewhere that you are a big fan of Notting Hill and Love Actually and all those sort of movies as well. Obviously rom-coms. Is that something you would like to do more of? Because I think of you more as a you're in more kind of dramas, action movies, that kind of thing, but rom-coms, is that something that you'd like to do more of?
Yeah, I would, but I think there hasn't been too many of them, right? I mean, I think the golden age of rom-coms was the 90s, I feel. I think we've kind of fallen out of that a little bit. Maybe when it comes back, I'll love to do one of them. I think Love Actually obviously is the is the granddaddy of them all, I think, because it's got so many great storylines and fantastic actors, and I think it's Richard Curtis at his peak, I think.
That is true, isn't it? It is a dying breed. There isn't I can't physically think of a rom-com recently that was great. And back in the 90s there would be one every month there'd be something coming out or and now it just feels like I mean maybe they started not being so bankable anymore. Hugh Grant got older and then he went off and did some dramas and that was the end of of the rom-com area. But yeah, it's a shame. It is a shame. You think Netflix or someone like that would I don't know. You think it would be easier to make one, but I guess it's difficult to make a new fresh rom-com that isn't kind of a rerun of one of these great films.
Beyond rom-coms, I think we don't even get that many comedies anymore, right? I mean, I don't think out and out comedies.
Yeah, I mean, Wedding Crashers and Superbad, American Pie, all those sort of American school like comedies, they're kind of not really a thing anymore, are they? And
Yeah, the raunchy ones, right? I mean, they were kind of like the analogous to the stuff in the 80s, which was Revenge of the Nerds and Porky's and
Porky's, yeah.
Just One of the Guys, and there were millions of them, and then we had a whole bunch of these movies, the Judd Apatow movies over the last decade, I think. So, but we're missing. We're obviously missing the airplanes, and these, and even, I mean, City Slickers, even, right? Remember that movie with Billy Crystal? I mean, we're kind of missing all of that, but obviously, and I've been a part of this world. I mean, superhero movies obviously dominate, right? This particular decade, and I think there have been the dominant genre and horror too. I mean, considering.
Definitely, definitely. Well, horror is almost it's a constant staple, isn't it? I think that's something that is there's always going to be horror films, I think. But in terms of like comic book movies, I mean you obviously you've done DC, you've done Marvel, you've done a bit of everything when it comes to that. Do you have a were you into comic books at all when you were younger? Do you have a favorite?
Oh, very much. I think it was just it really quite propitious and quite appropriate that The Dark Knight was actually the first movie that I did. I think Frank Miller's Dark Knight actually kind of blew my mind. I mean, it was one of the first few graphic novels I read, right? And then Alan Moore's The Killing Joke, and then there was The Long Halloween, I think, by Jeb Loeb, I think, and all that. All these graphic novels actually were kind of the inspiration for The Dark Knight, so it was quite appropriate because I think those were the ones that kind of opened my eyes to how possible, how possible this kind of storytelling was. But I also enjoyed a lot of the anime stuff because 90s in Japan, they also had some kind of Renaissance or golden age, with Akira and Ghost in the Shell, obviously, which I'm very familiar with. And so that stuff was super cool, right? I mean, the cyberpunk stuff was super super cool as well. So when I got The Dark Knight, That just seemed, I mean, I'm so grateful to have done it, and it's such an incredible experience to work with an incredible filmmaker, but it kind of feels, there's a sense of inevitability about it too, you know. But it's just me, I know.
It's funny that, when The Dark Knight came out, obviously, Batman Begins had already been a huge hit and it was a great film. But The Dark Knight really kind of transcended the whole landscape for movies like that. Did you have any idea when you were filming it? I know there's obviously, Christopher Nolan, all these things that it's obviously going to be a great film, but did you have any inkling that it was going to be as huge as it was when you were making it?
No, because if you watch the film, I think Chris is so masterful that way, right? I mean, his films feel so epic, but if you look at the scenes individually, they're actually small scenes, you know? I mean, the scene with me and Morgan Freeman is two of us. The scene with me and Maggie Gyllenhaal is two of us. The scene, I mean, there's one big action set piece in Hong Kong, where Christian Bale comes to get me, you know, and then it just felt, it does feel intimate, you know, on the Chris Nolan set. Then obviously he goes off and does those giant 18-wheeler flip over stunts, and those are incredible. But ultimately, I feel the movie really is about opposing forces, right? I think, and if you think even about the scenes between Two-Face and the Joker, or the Joker and Batman, they're small too, right? I mean, they're set in a jail cell, you know, and
Never
so.
thought of that before. It's very, he must be very good at budgeting a movie because he's like, right, we're doing this scene with three people in a little room. But yeah, it still has this scale where you think of the film as being this huge blockbuster, which it is. But yeah, I'd never really thought of that before. But that's probably why it works. There's a lot of intimate moments and you care about the characters because of that. Yeah, funny. I've never really thought of that before.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. I mean, and he's very, I mean, obviously, he is orchestrated so precisely too, right? So, I mean, I don't think anything is wasted. I think that movie is so lean as well. So, back to your question about whether I felt it was going to be the phenomenon or the game changer, you know, or the kind of movie, seminal movie that it has become. No, because it just felt very, you know, it felt very intimate to me.
I'd like to ask, you've worked with, and you mentioned a few of them there, some big names, people that I'm sure when you're thinking about it the day before, I'm thinking, God, I've got this scene with Morgan Freeman, like, better not screw this up. Doing a scene with, say, Robert Redford in, Captain America. What is that like? Because I mean, someone like Robert Redford is someone I'm sure that you knew of when you were younger watching movies. And then you have to go on and you're doing a movie with someone like that. I mean, it must be pretty surreal.
It is, right? I mean, the surreal and then the surreal, right? There's the surreal of a Christian Bale, because I mean, he was before Batman, you know. I mean, he had this. He almost had a cult, a cultish kind of following, right? With American Psycho, you know, and Shaft, and some of his edgier works. But so that's surreal. But then there's the surrealness of Morgan Freeman, which is the Shawshank Redemption, you know, and Seven, right? And then you have the surrealness of Robert Redford, who is The Sting, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and all that stuff. That's stuff that your parents watched, you know. And so there are different levels of surreal, and I think Robert Redford would be right up there. I think that would be peak surreal. but he was a movie star through and through. I mean, even him just stepping on stage. I always say this, that I don't know how he does it, but I mean, he when he walks on stage, is like he has a constant backlight, right? he's glowing, right? I feel. And then he has such, I mean, he has been in the business for so long. He's so grounded. He's so real, you know. I mean, there's such gravitas, you know. And I think I really believe, you know, I mean, the Russo brothers are terrific, and the Winter Soldier is a terrific film, but he totally elevated that film as well.
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing that he was going to be in it, and I was like, wow, Robert Redford's going to be in a Marvel movie. Like, that's gravitas beyond, like, that's just, they really excelled there, getting, you know, a living legend like that. I'm an actor as well, and I did a scene with Michael Caine a few years back, and I had a similar moment where, you know, you're doing the scene with someone like that, and for me, being British, Michael Caine is at the top of the, you know, he's an icon. And it's that weird moment of they're doing the scene with you and you're looking at them, and it's like you're watching a movie and you're like, oh shit, yeah, now I've got to do something. You know, it's that thing of you've got to really be on your game, because otherwise you just kind of, you know, stare them out.
I find directors, but I feel that way about directors as well, actually, to be honest. You know, when I met Roland Emmerich for the first time on 2012, I mean, of course, I mean, we're friends now, and I've done two movies with him, including Independence Day Resurgence. But I mean, this is the man who directed Universal Soldier, you know, Independence Day, Stargate, Godzilla. I geek out a little with directors, actually, too. Steven Soderbergh with Contagion, you know, and doing that really, you know, obviously now that movie has a different kind of significance, you know, but when we were doing it, I mean, it was just, I felt like we were doing a pandemic version of Traffic, right? Because there were so many different kinds of stories. But I do love directors, you know, too, and I do love watching directors work. I mean, all of them work differently. You know, they direct differently. Some are very spare. Some are a bit more involved. You know, some are like conductors, and some are like military generals. So, you know, I do enjoy watching them work. I mean, I'd like to direct at some point, obviously, and I don't think that's too far off.
Amazing! Yeah, I mean, that's, I think it always helps as well if I've had a few directors that were actors, or, you know, vice versa, like, kind of tried both on here, and it is, I think it must really help, because if you've been there and you've done that and you're an actor, you kind of, I think you have a slight different connection to the actors, and if you're directing them, you have a different insight and a different dynamic, which can only help, I would think.
Now for a quick break. Are you a writer and director, actor, costume designer, perhaps makeup artist? Are you interested in camera? This is the place to share your journey. We want to hear from you. How did you start your career? Has it started yet? And perhaps, if you're feeling brave, share with us your most embarrassing film-related moment. So slip into our DMs at Life and Film Pod on Instagram. Check out the Patreon at patreon.com/lifeandfilm. Where you'll get episodes early and uncut, amongst other treats. And don't forget to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you enjoy this episode, please leave us a positive rating. Add us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok at Life and Film Pod, and find our video episodes on YouTube by searching Elliot James Langridge Life and Film. Essentially, please like and subscribe everything. It makes a huge difference. Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you work in the film industry? Are you freelance? Or perhaps you have a 9-to-5? No matter what you do, mental health affects us all. I struggled early on in my career with the uncertainty of if and when I would ever work again, struggling to pay my bills, or simply with anxiety. Don't know about you, but being an actor, it's very important for me to maintain structure in the down times, and I found not only exercise, but talking to someone, for me, was a game changer. And so Life in Film has partnered with BetterHelp to provide you with access to the largest online therapy service in the world. And it can all be done from the comfort of your own home, from a phone, tablet or laptop. No commute, cutting down travel costs, and most importantly, it's affordable. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. If you need someone to talk to and you're thinking of giving therapy a go, BetterHelp is a great option. And being a listener of the podcast, you get 10% off. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/lifeinfilm. That's betterhelp.com/lifeinfilm.
And back to the show.
You've worked with all these amazing directors. Were any of the, you know, you've obviously, you mentioned a few there. Did any of them surprise you? Was there anything sort of that you didn't expect with their kind of methods that came about?
Oh, you know, they always are surprising in terms of, especially because, you know, so many of these directors I've worked with are so acclaimed, and you know, there's also Gus Van Sant, and you know, who I did Restless with, but I'm always surprised by how collaborative they are. I find that the more talented the director, the more, you know, I think the more they're excited by what you can bring. You know, I mean, they obviously have a very clear idea of the movie they're making, but if you can just bring them something, maybe you know, just kind of a twist on something, they get very excited about that. But Soderbergh in particular was very interesting because he's so hands-on, and even though he's directed all these big movies, you know, you can totally see his independent film roots because he is his own cinematographer as well. I don't know if you know this.
Yeah, I mean, that blows my mind.
Yeah.
So he hasn't got enough to do. Like, that's, yeah, it's mad.
Yeah, and he is so cool about everything. And after he finishes shooting, he tries to shoot everything in camera. After he finishes shooting, he's literally sitting in the hotel bar with his producer, Greg Jacobs. They have a corner to themselves, and they're on their laptop. They're looking at all the footage that they shot in the course of the day, and you know, and kind of figuring it out. So he's super super hands on, you know, and workmanlike with his films, which I love, obviously.
Well, obviously the movie Contagion, that's an example of a movie that obviously it did well when it came out, but then it had another life because obviously what was going on in the world, like the movie suddenly went to number one on Netflix. And it's this crazy thing that, you know, what's going on in the world mirrors, everyone wants to watch something that can kind of give them a bit of, yeah, I don't know. Like I watched it as well when it was all happening. It makes you kind of feel like a bit more in control to be able to watch a film like that. That's kind of touching the same notes as what's actually going on in the world.
It was interesting because when I did it, it was almost like looking back in the rearview mirror because I had gone through SARS, right? SARS was in the year 2003 in Asia. So when we did Contagion in 2010, did we shoot in 2011? I think for me, it was looking back in the rearview mirror. It was like, oh, okay, you know, it's something that we did and something that has already happened. And Scott Z. Burns did all the, you know, all the research and wrote an incredible script. Ian Lipkin, who was one of the preeminent virologists, was working on that too. And so as terrifying as it was, you know, we were doing it, I think, more as a record of the times, you know, in 2003. I didn't know it was actually foreshadowing what was going to happen in 2020. Yeah. And so, but I'm glad it was, you know, it was comforting, I guess is the word. I mean, for people like yourself.
Yeah, I don't know. There was some weird, weird comfort to be had from that, I think.
You know, people love this. It's good for you.
Right. This one looks like he's giving me the thumbs up.
So, do you have a lab partner yet?
Is there a Jim Wang here?
Wang.
This is Wayne Chung.
Wei Chen.
He's a new student and he's Chinese, like you. He's going to tag along to all of your classes.
I found seeds for us. Come on.
except in math. He's way ahead of you in math.
I just want to be a regular guy who does regular stuff.
You made a new friend.
Just thought this year was going to be different.
I may be able to help.
What's going on?
I'm not from this world. I need your help with my quest to stop the uprising.
The gate between Earth and Heaven is opening.
Okay!
You must stop it or everyone will perish. The fate of your world hangs in the balance.
I don't really see how I fit into this whole thing.
You're my guide.
Can we come up with something a little bit cooler than guide?
Servant?
Yeah, no, you're right. Guide's better.
It will be difficult and dangerous.
Be the hero.
What if I'm not, though?
Fate is not decided up there, but down here.
So freaking unbelievable.
Everything is more connected than you think.
Huh.
Yay.
But your new show for Disney Plus, what an amazing cast. How did this project come about? Was it a usual, I mean, you've worked with Michelle Yeoh before. Mm-hmm. How did you get involved in the project?
Well, it's really alchemy, right? I mean, the cast, you know, getting a cast like that together is, it really is timing. It is some kind of, it's some kind of very, very, I think kind of it's alchemy, really. I mean, I can't even describe it any other way, because for when we started shooting it, Michelle, Key, Stephanie Su, James Hong, I don't think had gotten his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame yet. He got it this year. And then they had finished Everything Everywhere All at Once. I remember even going to the premiere of Everything Everywhere All at Once while we were shooting American Born Chinese, because, you know, we were in the midst of it. And so we were shooting this really interesting graphic novel from Jin Lun Yang that he wrote in 2006, which is very surreal. I mean, it's surreal and very unique and very singular. I don't know if you've read the graphic novel.
No, I haven't, no.
It's about identity, but then it's also kind of fantastical, the mythological creatures, and suddenly the main character even it switches, personage somewhere in the middle of the graphic novel in an almost Lynchian kind of way. So the graphic novel was very interesting, but it deals with all these, you know, ideas of identity. So we were doing this graphic novel. I mean, it meant a lot. It meant different things to different people. I think for me, I think the family element was a big deal for me. I do all these big movies, and, you know, I play villains from time to time. I play, for lack of a better word, good guys, for example, in Skyscraper, you know, and a few other things. But I haven't really delved into that kind of character that had a domestic life, you know, as a mm-hmm. father, as a wife, as a husband, and so that was very appealing to me, especially, you know, in the wake of, as we were just talking, the aforementioned global pandemic. I think there was a lot of thought that was going through my head about, you know, families and mortality and immortality and having children, and, you know, and so that really struck a chord with me. And so that was why I was doing it. But what happened then while we were shooting was Everything Everywhere All at Once became this thing very, very slowly, right? It just kept hanging around in the box office top 10, and it was there, and it was months later, and, you know, and then people really, you know, it resonated with people, and you know, it became really successful. Mm. And then suddenly now we have two Oscar winners, one supporting actress nominee, James Hong with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. You know, we have Yo Yan Yan, who's a double Golden Horse winner, and a host of incredible young actors. And so I think it's just the film gods, really. I think we're smiling down on us. It's just, sometimes it just happens, you know, when all these things come together and you get to make something that you want to make, and for it to come out the way that you want it to come out, you know. Because as you know, if you make movies, you can do it with the best of intentions and it can become something else completely by the time you're done with it.
Oh, yeah.
But I think this is something that we are all collectively proud of.
And a great platform. And Disney Plus has been bringing out some amazing new projects. And as you say, that cast, I mean, the casting director must have been like, because to get that cast in the first place is incredible. But then for that timing to be on top of that as well is just, I mean, it doesn't get any better than that, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And having gone into like the stand-up comics, you know, big stand-up comics in the US right now, the Asian Americans, you know, Ronnie Cheng and Jimmy O Yang, I mean, they're here with us as well, everywhere you turn, right? I mean, it's quite fun.
That's incredible. I can't wait to see, because I haven't got a screen of it, but I can't wait to see it. I saw the trailer and it looks incredible. Yeah, it looks fun. And actually, in a way, there's elements to it, as you say, with Everything Everywhere All at Once. There's kind of there's definitely similarities between the two. And then obviously you see the cast as well, and you're like, hang on a minute. I mean, Everything Everywhere All at Once was an absolutely incredible film. One of those movies that when you're watching it in the cinema, people are reacting to it live, like screaming and shouting and laughing. And I don't know about you, but in America, maybe that happens a bit more, maybe when you're in LA, but like here, English people are dead silent usually through a movie. there's not much interaction, but that movie had a real, like, people were like cheering. It's one of those movies, they just like smashed it, really. I mean, it's incredible. I have to ask you before I let you go, Mortal Kombat is obviously a movie that was a huge success, and now there's going to be a sequel. Is there anything that you can sort of say about the next one? Someone's aiming at you through the window right now.
They'll have my soul, I think, for sharing anything. And obviously I'm invoking Shang Tsung here. It is a bigger movie. There are more characters. I think it's going to be fun. I mean, that's all I can say. I mean, there's, you know, I mean, some news have come out, you know, about certain actors joining the film, and I'm thrilled. I mean, it's going to be fun. We're about to start soon, so.
Amazing.
So you know, from this gloomy weather, I'm gonna be flying over to winter in Australia, which is just perfect, really.
Yeah, I look forward to it. I mean, I was always a fan of the Mortal Kombat movies of the 90s, and then when they said that this was coming, I was like, oh, like, I hope they don't screw up. Smashed it, loved it. So now that they're doing another one as well, I'm very much on board with that. So I can't wait. So yeah, very much looking forward to it. Most embarrassing moments,
yeah. Let's see. You know, it's hard for me to think. I mean, I I remember many, many moons ago when, you know, when I was still auditioning, I had brought all these props to an audition, and you know, and that was kind of embarrassing. I brought a phone, I think. no, one of those big
the ones where you have to do the button, like,
right, because I needed, that was before the time of obviously cell phones and stuff, so these smartphones and stuff, so I remember like being over prepared, right? I brought my own props. I was in costume, and then obviously the audition was a nightmare.
Is it safe to say you didn't get the part, or
yes it's very, very safe to say that. I don't even know what possessed me. I was sitting in the waiting room with this huge bulge in my jacket, which was, you know, the phone handle I had carried to the audition. But, you know, I think that's about the only one. If there was anything more embarrassing than that, I don't think I would be sharing.
But, you know, you've got to do trial and error, haven't you? You took that phone, it didn't work. You didn't take another phone to an audition. But after that, you knew that was the wrong thing to do.
Yeah. So it's funny, right? I mean, when you're a younger actor, you know, trying to get work and you know, saying what is it, right? I mean, I think I heard one of your podcasts with Toby Jones, where, you know, he was saying, don't do that. You know, if they say, can you write a horse? Don't do it, because I did that. I've done that before. When, can you ride a horse? Yeah, sure. Can you skydive? Done it before a million times. You know, deep sea diving. Yeah, you know, I mean, every weekend.
Oh, man.
Don't do that. Right. I mean, really, really, really don't do that.
Because that is the classic of, you know, oh, yeah, I could do it. And then you don't actually think about the fact that you're going to have to do it. And yeah. then you're a bit stuck. That was a musical instrument Toby was talking about. He just was like, yeah, I can do that. And they were like, here's a trumpet or whatever it was. And he's like,
Yeah, here's a bassoon.
It's the joys of being an actor. You've got to fake it until you make it, and you've well and truly made it. So this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting about your new show, and all the best with it, man.
Thank you. I hope you enjoy it. We had a blast making it, and I can't say enough about my co-stars. I love them so much, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Oh, well, yeah. Wicked, man. Thank you so much. All right, take care. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
It's a laugh and film, motherfucker. Subscribe and like and follow.
Thank you to our guest Chin Han, and thank you to Imprint PR, and as always, thank you to our sponsor, BetterHelp.
In Taiwan, people love this. It's good for you.
This one looks like it's giving me the thumbs up.
American-born Chinese mainly focuses on Jin Wong, an Asian-American kid who's just trying to fit in at his high school.
What are you laughing at?
Please don't do that. Everybody is staring at us.
He's realizing that his cultural heritage and even the way he looks kind of makes him an outsider in his school community.
What could go wrong?
Easy there, Jin.
Jin! My name is Jin!
As I was growing up as an Asian American kid, there wasn't shows for kids like me on TV.
With this show, we can really dig into the deeper nuances of what it's like to grow up Asian American.
The core of the story is about family.
And for many Asian Americans or children of immigrants, their parents are their one tie to their mother culture.
It's a show that we wanted to exist for many, many years.
In this particular show, there are Asian costume designers, producers, and writers.
American-born Chinese is really, truly something I've never seen on American TV. It's multicultural.
There's a lot of Mandarin.
你有空跟金靖多讲中文啊?
It's based on one of my favorite comic.
The show is based on a graphic novel by Jin Lun Yang.
For people in my community, everybody is aware of the American-born Chinese book.
I think it's a beautiful way to learn more about some of our best mythological creatures from Journey to the West.
In China, the Journey to the West novel is considered one of the four pillars of Chinese literature.
I hope our series teaches the audience the beauty of being different.
We all should embrace each other for what we are.
Yeah, like you don't ever really doubt yourself.
Why would I doubt myself?